I think something that's quite necessary or essential for our practice is the creating the feeling or creating the perception in our mind that we have, that we've actually got the time to practice. So often you hear it so often, you know, I don't have the time to practice. And it doesn't actually matter whether one is a monk or a nun or a layperson, whether one lives in America or lives in Thailand. That's sort of a common refrain, is I don't have the time to practice. And I think so much of the feeling of I don't have time is not so much that we don't actually have the time, but that we either create a perception that we don't have time, or we kind of fill our life up with things that just keep us busy all the time and are not particularly discerning as to how essential or non-essential it is. So that to really be attentive to that feeling in the mind, feeling in the heart, that I don't have time to practice, I don't have time to meditate. When people would say that to Ajahn Chah, and it doesn't matter whether one is America, Western or Asian, it's the same thing. Thai people would go to Ajahn Chah and sort of say, I don't have time to meditate. And Ajahn Chah would sort of ask back, do you have time to breathe? Say, okay. People would always say, yeah, I've got time to breathe. They say, okay, then you've got time to meditate. But if you're one is this the sense of actually being attentive to the breath, actually taking the breath as an object, as a focus of attention, whether one is working or engaged in activity, one still has the breath to tap into and be attentive to. And that is also laying the foundations for meditation. Also in the sense that how Ajahn Chah would talk about it, in terms of creating a different perception, in the sense that one doesn't question the fact that one has, one makes the time to breathe, and one doesn't sort of just stop breathing and I'm so busy, I've got to do this and I've got to do that. One makes the time to breathe, because one realizes that one can't actually do without it. And similarly, to recollect the actual need to meditate, to practice Dhamma, to train the heart in ways that are peaceful, being able to relinquish attachments and tension, obsessions. Because in the same way that if one doesn't breathe, then one becomes uncomfortable very quickly. If one isn't being attentive, one isn't being centered, focused, mindful, peaceful, relinquishing obsessions and attachments, then one becomes very uncomfortable also. The heart becomes restricted, constricted, and one feels suffering. So that, in the same way that we have a physical need to breathe, we have a physical and mental, emotional need to put the Dhamma squarely in our life, to not sideline it or keep putting it off. When I've got the time, to do it, then I'll meditate or whatever. When circumstances are all appropriate, convenient, suitable, then I'll meditate, then I'll practice Dhamma. Just something that we need to bring into our life all the time. So that sense of you know, really recognizing the importance of our meditation practice, of our applying the principles of the Buddha's teachings in our day-to-day life. I remember one time talking with Ajahn Sujito, and he was musing about an encounter that he'd recently had. This was many years ago. He'd gone to a prison to visit Buddhists who were there at the prison, and he can be pretty unworldly at times. And he, but anyway, he had the idea that if you're a Buddhist in prison, then you'd meditate. You have all this time to meditate. So he went and visited the prison, and he said, it was very fascinating because this particular prisoner sort of was saying, you know, because Ajahn Sujito sort of, you know, asked him, you know, how much time he set aside for meditation, and sort of, oh, meditation, I don't have time for meditation. Oh, you know, Monday they've got us doing this, and then Tuesday they've got us doing a workshop, and then we've got to do, Wednesday we're doing mail sorting, and you know, and then he goes through the whole week, and there's just no time left for meditation. You know, and how much of it is perception, and how much of it is it very familiar? It's just, you know, even if we really didn't have anything to do, we would still find something to do. Stranded on a desert island somewhere and coming up with projects to count the grains of sand. I mean, it would become very important all of a sudden to know exactly how many grains of sand on a beach there were. We'd find something to do. So that sense of time is very, we have to be attentive to how we're utilizing it, and also how we're perceiving it, because it does play an important role. I recently read an account of a psychology experiment that they did at Princeton, and it was done with the Princeton Theological Seminary, and the idea that they had was you know, in terms of behavior, what condition people's responses. And they conducted the experiments with the seminarians, the students, and thinking about how people react to the world around them, and using the story of the, say, of the Good Samaritan from from the Bible, and of course the story of the Good Samaritan is that this person was beaten and robbed and then left for dead on the road, various good people walked past this poor person, and then it was a Samaritan who was a member of a despised minority, sort of an outcast in the time of Jesus, that was that actually stopped and looked after the person, bound their wounds, took them to an inn, and cared for them. And with that sort of theme, then they had people what they did was they had them, were going to have them give a talk at a particular place, and they arranged for this for an actor to be along the sidewalk or along the air. They had to pass by this person who was sort of bent over, moaning, coughing, obviously in discomfort and pain, and they wanted to see what sort of reaction these people had. So, and they threw a few variables in. Such as the people who are doing the experiment would sit down with the people before they went off to give this talk, and would ask them about, let's say, these two sort of questions about, and do a fill in a questionnaire about what were their kind of intentions or motivations when they were taking the religious vocation, and to either sort of classify it in terms of their personal kind of feeling of aspiration or their personal quest for religious or spiritual understanding, or their kind of social, how they perceive the kind of the social function of a religious seeker. So that was a variable. And then another variable was the actual content of the talk that they were supposed to be giving, and to go over a bit with them what their the content of the talk, and of course one of the subjects that they actually asked them to give the talk on was the biblical story of the Good Samaritan, and then another one was a talk on some extraordinarily dry and boring topic like the religious significance. The religious and social significance of the Christian minister in society. It was just something really boring, and there was some other variables. And then the other variable which they used was just before they went to give the talk, then they would one way of sort of saying, oh gee, we've been talking a long time, you're late for the talk now, you better get over there and give that talk. So the perception that they were late, and the other was just this, okay, you've got a few minutes, the talk is going to start in a bit, and and you better, get over there. So that they, with all the different people, the seminarians that they sort of trusted and did this experiment with, the interesting results was that, say, the variable around their personal or social interest, or whether it was like a personal quest for liberation or a compassionate quest of using the religion or studying the religion, that didn't really make much of a difference. The fact that the content of what they were preparing their talk about, whether they were talking about the Good Samaritan or not, that didn't really make much of a difference in terms of how many people stopped. It was about pretty much about the same as comparable. But what really made a difference was the feeling of being late or not, that they had the time to stop. And apparently it was only about the, for the people who were given that idea that they were late, there was only 10% of the people stopped, whereas and they said, and they would almost sometimes have to step over these people who were writhing on the ground and obviously experiencing difficulty, whereas the feeling that they had time, there was 63% of the people stopped. So that this whole perception of time is, it's really, it needs to be considered and reflected on, and how we, what kind of say atmosphere of pressure we put on ourselves in different situations, whether it's in the world responding to our duties, whether it's in our spiritual practice, that whole realm of the kind of expectations that we put on ourselves, the feeling I don't have time, or how we clutter our lives up and minds up with either both busyness as well as the feeling that there's not space around us, because that all creates the feeling that I'm pressured. I don't have time. I can't deal with this. So that really bringing up those that sense of being present for what one's doing, and realizing that one actually does have whatever one creates the perception of time for, one has the time for. So much of our feeling of what, because we can only do so much anyway. It's like oftentimes, and the great example is always that I like using is Ajahn Buddhadasa, who's a very highly respected Thai monk, and many years ago, he died 10 or so years ago probably, and then when he was a younger monk and still building his monastery, there was one time when he was building this particular hall, kind of ordination hall, and he was doing it so it was going to be kind of a multifunctional. And so it's quite large and a bit of a different design. It was in Thai, the ordination hall is called a boat. It's Thai's like to abbreviate a lot of the words they use. It comes from the Uposatha hall, so they just go, oh, boat. So he was doing a play on words, and he actually made this building look like kind of a boat in the land. And so he was overseeing the construction, and it was toward afternoon, and this layperson comes along and sort of says, "Oh, this is huge, this is big, you know, this is, you know, bigger than anything you've ever built here." I said, when are you ever going to be finished? And he says, "Finished this evening." And I said, "What do you mean, finished this evening?" He says, "Well, I come and help out or look over things and see how they're doing during the day, and when it's evening time, and it's put it down. Tomorrow's another day. If I'm alive, then I'll come and see how they're doing. But otherwise, it's done. It's finished." And that, you know, that perception, he's had the time for everything. And the same thing would be in terms of, you know, if he was sitting and receiving somebody, talking to receiving guests. That would be what he would be doing. That's what he had time for. And there wasn't a sense of, I got to get this out of the way so I can do something else. Or this is an impingement on me because I've got to be doing something else. That this is what needs to be done. This is what I'm doing. This is what I'll be attentive to. It's not necessarily that consciously thought through, but that's the feeling that was created. So that being attentive to that, because we do fill the emotional space with the perceptions of, you know, this has to be done, I've got to get that done, or this is looming, this is something which is worrisome, or that has to be done somehow, or something has got to be done about it, and it's sort of vaguely formulated in the mind, and it's looming on the edge of consciousness, and it's just sort of like there, it's like an ogre, you're sort of waiting to get on us. And all it is a perception. One isn't actually present with what one is doing. And one is being impinged upon by something other, something else. But noticing how we do that, notice the habits that we get into in terms of, you know, just, you know, so like in engaging with things, just how we sometimes, you know, stack things up so that we do get a feeling of impingement, or are we feeling that not enough time? But it's just sort of remembering, okay, this is what I've got the time to do, and this is what I'm doing. Also, just noticing how we relate to things. Something shows itself in many different ways, and it's helpful. I remember one time for myself, I met somebody who was a handwriting, they'd analyze handwriting, and she just asked me to write something on a sheet of paper, and I did that, and then gave it to her, and one of the things she pointed out immediately should have been really obvious, is that I didn't have much space around it. I filled everything up. And, you know, there's this was that. And that he said, you know, and I bet you do that. You know, that's something that you do as a habit in your life. You don't, you know, it's like just creating the margins around things, not filling things up. And that was really helpful, because then I started really looking at the habits that I'd got myself into of doing that. Just and you know, and it shows up on just a piece of paper when we write something down on something simple like that and basic. You know, how we, you know, take a piece of paper and you know, write a note and then fill it up completely and sort of write little things elsewhere on the note, squeezing it in. So that sense of creating space around things, because it's in the same way as that sense of creating time for practice, creating the atmosphere for practice, that we're not feeling pressured or pushed or impinged on. It's just so important. As I can remember, Ajahn Chah is sometimes giving meditation instruction, how he would just start by, when he'd lead a meditation, sometimes he would just sort of say, just imagine yourself sitting on top of a mountain. Just on your, and this is even when we're say at Wat Pho Phong, where we're living in a monastery, in a forest. But again, you know, the perceptions can be, you know, I'm living with all these people, and sometimes two can be all these people. I mean, just it doesn't have to be a lot in numbers. It's just, but it feels like a lot. So that the and he would say that, you know, just imagine you're on top of a mountain. You know, you're on you're by yourself, right? And just by creating that perception, it just opens up that feeling of space. Or I remember him, you know, so many times starting the meditation by, you know, just when we're sitting together as a group, and he's just saying, "You just be attentive to the breath. Don't take on the perception of anybody being around you. Imagine that you're by yourself. Just be present with the breath." And you know, those are very helpful perceptions to plant in the mind. It's just that sense of, I've got the time, I've got the space, I've got the just shedding the things that tend to that we tend to carry that create a sense of agitation or feeling of obstruction, because it's important to actually investigate, you know, how much of the obstruction that we feel in meditation and our living the teachings, you know, how much of that is, you know, so-called real, or is it perceived? And of course, if we perceive it, then it is real. You know, it doesn't, you know, just because you know, we're not being sort of flogged or beaten or something, doesn't mean that when we have a perception of feeling impinged on, or that we don't have time to meditate, that it doesn't, you know, it doesn't feel like that is really how it is. So that how can we loosen around that? How can we expand around that? How can we create that quality of just attentiveness, acceptance of what the situation is in the present moment, and coming back to the qualities of mindfulness, awareness, investigation, compassion. Again, like that, just having the coming back to that experiment, just having the time to be compassionate. Because that's that quality of compassion isn't just say being a good Samaritan helping somebody else out there. It's also having a feeling of time and just being compassionate towards ourselves. You know, how much do we drive ourselves or distract ourselves so that we forget to be compassionate to ourselves? It's a lot of the time. It's very the habits are very strong, and particularly in, let's say, like a society like America that is sort of so devoted to busyness, so devoted to activity, so devoted to sort of external expressions of everything. It's easy to forget, and it's essential to really consciously bring up the some reminders and encouraging oneself to creating that atmosphere of practice, creating the context for us to draw on the qualities which we really have. Again, sort of coming back to that experiment, and the people who were seminarians, obviously good moral people, but because there was that creation of a context of not having time, then those compassionate qualities, those qualities of goodness, didn't have an opportunity to shine forth. They were neglected, and just by creating that feeling, the perception of having time, then those qualities came forth to such a striking degree. So that this, the same happens with us. Giving ourselves the opportunity to allow our goodness to come forth, allow our peace to come forth. It isn't as if peace or wisdom or compassion are things that we don't have and we've got to struggle and fight and finally we'll get it somehow way down the line. These are qualities which we have. We wouldn't be sitting here on a Saturday night if we didn't. We wouldn't be living in a monastery if we didn't have those qualities. But recognizing that we have to be attentive to the supportive conditions so that they are able to really shine forth. So those are a few reflections this evening. Offer that.